lovely being back in the Freud Museum. I'm going to talk about music. Music which transcends that which is human, or so, of course, musicians claim. Daniel Chua, the great musicologist, in his book on absolute music, points out the more music claims not to tell you a story, the more it's telling you a story. And I want to tell you one of those stories tonight, the story of Jews, music, and modernity in Vienna. But I'm going to weave my way through Europe on my way to Vienna. Let us start here. Let us start in England. Let us start with Shakespeare. Shylock is denounced as a man that hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds. Therefore, he is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as Erebus. Let no such man be trusted. Mark the music. Mark the music. Only good people appreciate music. Only moral people, but certainly not Jews. Now that's a truism. We find it in the 19th century over and over again. Robert Knox, best known as the man who bought the bodies from Burke and Hare. Robert Knox, in the first book of systematic biological racism of the 19th century, The Races of Man, observed that the real Jew has no ear for music. And of course, Richard Wagner, in that first anonymous essay on Jewry and music, argued that the Jew has never had an art of his own, and it's never a life of art-enabling importance, an import, an universally applicable, a human import, not even today does it offer to the searcher, but merely a peculiar method of expression. Jewish music is only music by Jews. And Jews come to believe it. In Vienna, the end of the 19th century, Gustav Mahler, After the performance of his last symphony, several critics noticed that Mahler could not free himself from the reminiscences of the masters he admired and resembled the features and attitudes of every model who has ever influenced his with their relevant composition. Mahler, the Jewish composer, as Wagner said, could never be original, could never have life-affirming art, could only copy. And Mahler's music would speak Yiddish. A critic writes in 1912, it would be unintelligible to me, but it is repulsive to me because it acts Jewish. That is to say, it speaks musical German, but with an accent, with an inflection, and overall with the gestures of an Eastern, all too Eastern Jew. Even to those whom it does not offend directly, cannot possibly communicate anything. One does not have to be repelled by Mahler's artistic personality in order to realize the complete emptiness and vacuity of an art in which the spasm of an impotent mock Titanism reduces itself to a frank ratification of common seamstress-like sentimentality. He doesn't like Mahler. But, you know, Mahler's friends aren't much better. Richard Specht, in one of the best books of the time on Mahler. Mahler, and likewise his music, is a Jew, and Jewish in the thrusting energy of his mindset, in the feverish restlessness of his search after meaning and lawfulness in the world, in the passionately dark ardor, in the occasionally unevenness, and even in the occasionally oversubtlety of his being. You can't win for losing, right? Mahler, by the way, a Christian convert. Mahler, a Jew in spite of himself, says in a conversation and Wagner in September of 1898, although I'm convinced that Mime in the Ring des Nibelungen is the embodied persiflage of a Jew, as intended by Wagner, all the traits which he gave him, his petty cleverness, greed, and all the complete musically and textually excellently manifested jargon, Yiddish, that should not be exaggerated and dished up so thickly here in Vienna. I know only one Mime. We all looked at him anxiously, and that is me. You will be surprised to see what lies in the part and what I could make of it. Wagner in the Jew's Opera. Now, this notion that music, somehow or another, is that space where belonging to Western civilization, where being able to appreciate the transcendental is located, the ethereal, the true, the beautiful, has an odd no echo in this house. Well, at least in the most famous inhabitant of this house. In Freud's Moses of Michelangelo, he comments that works of art do exercise a powerful effect on me, especially those of literature and sculpture. We know that, less often of painting. This has occasioned me, when I have been contemplating such things, to spend a long time before them trying to apprehend them in my own way. That is, to explain to myself what their effect is due to. In other words, when I look at the Moses of Michelangelo, when I look at Leonardo's paintings, I have an affect, and I want to understand what that affect is from. And that's what his books, when he writes about culture, are about. But then he says, wherever I cannot do this, as for instance with music, I am almost incapable of obtaining any pleasure. Some rationalistic or perhaps analytic turn of mind in me rebels against being moved by a thing without knowing why I am thus affected and what it is that affects me. It's very interesting. Freud's a very smart man. When he says, when I get pleasure from something, I want to analyze why I get pleasure. But when he gets no pleasure from something, like music, he doesn't ask why suddenly this rational response is present. So Jews and music, evidently, certainly in the 19th century, Jews in Western music, Jews in classical music, Jews in high art, in the symphony hall, in the opera, are oil and water. But it's also exactly the opposite that is true. Disraeli, in his first great novel, Coningsby, in 1845, Disraeli, like Mahler, Jewish and not quite Jewish enough, writes, "Musical Europe is ours, for every time a Christian listens to a Rossini or a Meyerbeer or is thrilled into raptures at the notes of an aria by a Pastor or a Grisi, little do they suspect that they are offering their homage to the sweet singers of Israel. The Jews are endowed," Disraeli writes, "with the almost exclusive privilege of music." And by the way, if you're looking at the footnotes, Meyerbeer is Jewish, Rossini, no way. But makes no difference. Makes no difference, right? Makes no difference. Jews own Western music. Jews own performance of high culture. His contemporary George Eliot, in that great proto-Zionist novel, Daniel Deronda, in 1876, says that her Jewish protagonists had not only one of those thrilling boy voices which seemed to bring an idyllic heaven and earth before our eyes, but a fine musical instinct. And the word is instinct. It's instinct. Jews have an instinctual relationship to high art, to high culture, to musical culture in Europe. Popular culture in England agrees. B.L. Farjian's Aaron the Jew, a novel of 1895, the Jewish character, Mr. Moss, the pawnbroker, hums the jewel song in Faust, not because he's a musician, but because the instincts of his race had welded the divine art into his soul. So Jews own it. instinctually, it's part of who they are as human beings. If music is transcendental, if music is beyond expression, Jews own that, even in Vienna. In Vienna, at the end of the 19th century, there is an extraordinarily popular writer. He's the equivalent to Neil Simon. He writes light boulevard comedies. They sell out. He's very popular. He's invited, therefore, to become an essayist, a feuilletonist, for the major daily newspaper, the New Free Press, the Neue Freie Presse. He is, as we would say today, hot. He is the Andrew Lloyd Webber of his day. But also, he is Theodor Herzl. Herzl's conversion experience on the road to Paris, or in Paris, from boulevard playwright to Zionist prophet, I don't have to rehearse with you. But when he's writing Der Judenstaat, when he's writing this extraordinary account of this imagined Jewish state, culture, the culture that Jews own, is writ very large. In his diaries, he records writing the Judenstaat. During the last 2 months of my residence in Paris, I wrote the book, The Judenstaat, The Jewish State. I do not recollect ever having written anything in such an elevated frame of mind as that book. I worked on it every day until I was completely exhausted. My only relaxation in the evening was consisted of listening to Wagner's music, especially to Tannhäuser, an opera I went to every time it was performed. Only on the evenings when there was no performance at the opera did I feel doubts about the correctness of my ideas. Oh, Jews own music. Jews own the transcendental. And there's nothing more Jewish for Herzl than the idea of a Jewish space in the world. Inspired, of course, by Wagner. And I don't mean that merely as a joke. Because if you read the Judenstaat, one of the things that happens is that Wagner writes of the new Jewish state as an opera. We cannot journey out of Egypt today, meaning out of Europe, in the primitive fashion of ancient times. First we have to do is we shall previously obtain an accurate account of our number and strength, as Moses does, right? Leaving Egypt. The undertaking of that great and ancient gesture of the Jews in primitive days, taking a census, in other words, and this is what's so lovely, bears much the same relation to ours as some wonderful melody bears to a modern opera. We are playing the same melody with many more violins, flutes, harps, cellos, and bass viols, with electric light, decorations, choirs, beautiful costumes, and with the finest singers of their day. In other words, Palestine, Israel, Zion, is Tannhäuser. This idea in Vienna permeates the way that the Viennese Jews understand music. Theodor Reich, one of the first generation of psychoanalysts, PhD in psychology, analyzed by Carl Abraham, which is important to my story, wrote the only, by the way, the first and the only major book written by that first generation of psychoanalysts on music. They are so music-averse because Freud is music-averse that it takes Reich until 1953 to write his book, The Haunting Melody. In it, he tells a story, and I'll tell it to you as he does. Reich describes his feelings after being informed of the death of his analyst, Carl Abraham. his friend, mentor, and former analyst. Reich recalls a reaction of intense shock, which is soon overtaken by numbness, but admits feeling no immediate grief. Walking alone through a snowy wood, he tries to focus his thoughts on composing a speech Freud has asked him to deliver in Abraham's memory at the next meeting of the Viennese Psychoanalytic Society. But he's too inwardly absorbed by his mood to concentrate. He notes that the trees have suddenly become menacingly high and that the landscape itself had been transformed into something solemn and sinister. He is aware of a heavy and oppressive silence. Amid this somber reflection, he becomes aware of humming a melody to himself. At first unrecognized, the refrain eventually reveals itself to be the first bars of the chorale from the last movement of Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection. A bit later, he recalls the text that the chorus sings to the accompaniment of that particular melody he keeps on hearing in his mind's ear. "You will rise again, my dust, after a short rest. Immortal life will he be granted who called." Reich realizes that the strain of music and its accompanying text has become the leitmotif of his mourning. But far from consoling him, it begins to occur with such intrusive insistence, becomes an earworm. You all have had that experience, right? Can't get a tune out of your head, as to become a disturbance. He wonders what his unconscious is communicating by way of this motif. The experience, he writes, was that he could hear its message, but could not understand its meaning. It was as if it had been expressed in a foreign language he did not speak. Mahler, The Resurrection, a memorial for Carl Abraham, a Jewish psychoanalyst. How Jewish is that? Christ rising. It's very Jewish. Walter Benjamin writes, "Das Jüdische goes without saying. Even the Christian in Vienna becomes Jewish." I'll point out to you, by the way, that the most Jewish composer of the late 19th century is Bach. Why? Because he is an invention of Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn, by the way, three generations already a Christian, rediscovers Bach. Mendelssohn decried as a Jew. Bach, the perfect Christian composer, becomes associated with this first resurrection now as part of Jewish music. Now, we've been talking about creating music, about living music, about experiencing music. But what about performing it? Heinrich Berl in 1926 in Martin Buber's periodical The Jew writes that the Jews are a form-creating people, not a cultural people. They had already shown this in their musical tradition of the liturgy. This is, by the way, what Wagner was talking about with Jewish music. Jewish music is fine as long as you're talking about synagogue liturgy, which had infiltrated their attempts to write modern music as early as Meyerbeer. Thus, they created modern music, Mahler and Schoenberg, without melodic quality. In other words, it's just a continuation of synagogue music, because the Jews lack the melodic capacity that provides the sense of space in music. As a people without space, this affects their musical creativity. Mahler is, in point of fact, the perfect example. But it's also in performance. Jewish virtuosi show similar qualities to composers. They may have genius and invention, Bell writes, but they are not creative, for they cannot make music truly sensual. Again, this is Wagner. The audience is enraptured by their playing, right? The audience is captured by this virtuosity because they are actors who transmute music into the visual world of appearances. Music, Bell stresses, is not visual. It does not paint, it sings. The Jewish performer, Bell writes in 1926, however, can only perform, not inhabit, the work of art. Now I want to talk a little bit about performance, and I want to look at one instrument, and that's the violin. Certainly in the 19th century, if we thought about the virtuoso on the violin, it had to be Paganini. Paganini so dominated the public's imagination as the essential violinist that he was. It was said that he was had learned his craft because he was aligned with the devil. Tales that are told, by the way, about early jazz musicians also. But Paganini's lifetime is, in point of fact, really the beginning of Romantic music. By the time, and we've been looking at the end of the 19th century, by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, and again in Vienna, the Paganini equivalent as the virtuoso of the time is Joseph Joachim, who dies in 1907, Brahms' great friend. All right? Now, you have to bear with me, and some of you are old enough to understand this tale I'm going to tell you, because I want to think with you about who are the three most famous violinists of the 20th century, that is, after Joachim. And if you ask any member of the generation who grew up after World War II, the answer to my question is, of course, very easy. Heifetz, without any question. Yasha Heifetz, no question about it. Number one on the list, Yasha Heifetz. Number two, a little bit more complicated, Jack Benny. Right? Well, I said famous. I said famous. I didn't say good. You have to read along with me, right? I said famous. But I would even make an argument that more famous than Heifetz and more famous than Jack Benny as a violinist in the 20th century is, of course, Einstein. No question that Einstein is the most famous Jewish violinist of the 20th century. Einstein said in an interview, had I not become a scientist, I would have become a musician. I live my daydreams in music. By the way, for people who played with him, they would not have agreed. He was a good amateur musician who had slight trouble keeping time, which he didn't tell him. Because he was like Albert Einstein, right? Einstein's notion of music, however, is that it's part and parcel of his life, of his essence. Music does not influence research work, but both are nourished by the same sort of longing, and they complement each other in the release they offer. This idea of music and the violin as, in a sense, being part and parcel of who you are continues in a very odd way. This is 1930. It's in the Great Synagogue in Berlin, playing Bach, actually playing the second movement of Bach's Adagio in B minor for two violins, and a fundraising benefit for the youth department of the Jewish community. And remember, I said that Bach was a Jewish composer. The other violinist, by the way, playing with Einstein, is a point of fact, a rather well-known violinist of the time, and that's Alfred Lewandowski. And those of you who know anything about Jewish liturgical music in the 19th century know that Alfred Lewandowski's father was Louis Lewandowski, one of the greatest Jewish liturgical composers of the day. Being Jewish, playing Bach, playing with other Jewish musicians, is in point of fact pointing toward the transcendental, pointing toward the real. In 1930, Einstein heard Bruno Walter conducting the Berlin Philharmonic with a very young Yehudi Menuhin, and he said, "Now I know that there's a God in heaven." Interesting, when Einstein talks about God, and he talks about God in the abstract, often with his physics, it becomes part and parcel of, in a sense, who he is, what his identity is, now as a violinist, as a Jew, as a citizen of the world. And there's a moment, and it's a PR moment, but it's a very interesting moment, in July of 1930, when the two Nobel Prize winners, the Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore and Einstein, meet in Einstein's summer house in Kaput, outside of Potsdam. And their conversation is recorded. I mean, these are two extraordinary people of the time. Tagore says, "It's difficult to analyze the effect of Eastern and Western music on our minds. I'm deeply moved by the Western music. I feel that it is great, that it is vast in its structure and grand in its composition. Our own music, however, touches me more deeply by its fundamental lyric appeal. European music is epic in character. It has a broad background and is Gothic in its structures." Einstein, who is a very smart man, answers, "This is a question we Europeans cannot properly answer. We are so used to our own music. Not we Jews, not we players of Bach, we Europeans. We want to know whether our own music is a conventional or a fundamental human feeling, whether to feel consonance and dissonance is natural or a convention which we accept." In other words, he throws open the whole question, which is the question that I'm trying to address today. But how much of music is, in point of fact, experiential and human, and how much of it is cultured and colored by our culture? But Tagore's response seems to me the perfect response to Einstein. "Somehow the piano confounds me." And he looks at Einstein and says, "The violin pleases me much more." Now, the idea that music has meaning because we give it meaning is something that Einstein throws open as a real question. Is it the fact that we, in a sense, bring meaning to the music, that we learn music, and we learn all of the attendant things that music brings along with it, whether we are able to accept it or not accept it, we are able to identify it or not identify it, because of who we are and where we are and who we believe we are, is extraordinarily important. But the 1920s, this whole notion of Jewish music, which had been suspect from Wagner on, becomes unhealthy music. Now, it's Koenig's opera, Yoni Strikes Up, combined a composer married to Mahler's daughter and black jazz. It was degenerate music and not at all a healthy combination for the Nazis in 1927 Vienna. The Holocaust, in a complicated way, draws the cultural experience of Jews in Europe not to an end, but into focus. One of the things that is quite extraordinary is that at least in Theresienstadt, children's operas are written and performed. Opera becomes part of the Jüdischer Kulturbund, the Nazis' organization for Jewish culture. And indeed, the head of the Jüdischer Kulturbund is a noted opera director. But by 1946, that world, in a sense, has imploded. The Holocaust is a reality. The destruction of much of Central European Jewry, all too real. 20 years later, Gershom Scholem is asked to contribute an essay to a Festschrift on the German-Jewish symbiosis, on the relationship between Germans and Jews, so extraordinarily destroyed by the Holocaust. Scholem, who had been in Israel well before the Nazis' ascension to power, in Palestine well before the Nazis' ascension of power, writes the following. I deny that there has ever been such a German-Jewish dialogue in any genuine historical sense whatsoever, that is, as a historical phenomenon. It takes two, it's a very famous phrase, it takes two to have a dialogue. Nothing can be more misleading than to apply such a concept to the discussions between Germans and Jews during the last 200 years. To be sure, the Jews attempted a dialogue with the Germans, starting from all possible points of view and situations, demandingly, imploringly, and entreatingly, servile and defiant. And he ends the letter. And today, when the symphony is over, the time may be ripe for studying their motifs and for attempting a critique of their tones. Remember Herzl. Remember Tannhäuser. Remember the opera as the model for Zion. For Scholem, the collapse of any type of Jewish presence in Western culture, in German culture, especially high culture, is the end of the symphony. But of course it's not. Of course it's not. Jews are present in high culture in Europe. They are present in high culture throughout the post-Holocaust world. But they become, in an odd way, assimilated, integrated. We, at the end of the 20th century, have the experience now of the new Jews. In 1976, Scholem writes of the end of the symphony. At the same time, in Dürlen Hall in Rotterdam, Yitzhak Perlman and Pinchas Zuckerman are performing. But who's behind Perlman and Zuckerman? Who's hiding? Is it the new Jews? Yes, of course it is. When we start to think about the violinists of the end of the 20th century, and I will consider the cello as a big violin for the moment, we start to think of the new Jews as the Asians. The Asians, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Koreans, their children playing cello and violin and even the tuba. In 2003, the Viennese Philharmonic hired its first Asian musician, a Japanese tubist named Yatsu Sugiyama. Asian students comprise 25% of music students in Vienna, yet the Philharmonic's only non-white musician, tuba player Yatsu Sugiyama, was fired before he completed his trial year in 2003. And the rationale, well, we've heard the rationale before. Dr. Clemens Heilsberg, Viennese Philharmonic Orchestra chairman, says that although he didn't fit, Sugiyama is maybe one of the best tuba players in the world. He says that even sitting in the audience, I could hear how differently he played compared to the rest of the orchestra. Too Jewish, perhaps? Music has meaning. It has the meaning we give it. It has the meaning we believe it to have. What is so striking about the trajectory of Jews within high culture, especially musical culture, is that they go from being outsiders to being insiders to being invisible. But there are always new Jews who take on that role. As the Levi Rye Bread advertisement said in the 1960s, you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levi's rye. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much for a very brilliant and truly challenging lecture. And I'm sure there must be questions in the floor. Yes, please.
No, I mean I take your point. Well, obviously, I was giving, a sort of pointillistic set of images, but you're quite right. I think it's more complicated, obviously, than one can give in a 45-minute presentation, because when you then start to look at the audiences, and we have pretty good measures. If you look, for example, at the people in Bayreuth who belong to the official organization which supports Bayreuth, it is heavily Jewish. The magazine that this organization publishes is heavily anti-Semitic, right? And so you start to ask yourself questions about how do you negotiate this? How do you negotiate being part of an audience where you're really not welcome as part of the audience, but you're a major part of the audience? And the question of what does Jewish mean, of course, gets immediately thrown up, because, of course, Jewish does not mean, right, a member of the Jewish religious community, right? I mean, that is a very narrow definition. Most of the people that we're talking about are Christian converts. As I said, with Mendelssohn already, Mahler certainly, but with Mendelssohn already, Mendelssohn's cousin Arthur is the best known writer of Protestant hymns of his generation. So if you go into the Protestant hymn book, you will find Arthur Mendelssohn's name over and over again of the period, right? And yet everybody knew who was Jewish. So your comment is well taken. Thank you.
I'd like to look at the effect of black music and the Nazi view that Jews were behind this
thing. Yeah. Well, let me start with the question of degenerate music. The poster you describe, of course, is the poster for the Nazi exhibit. And so there is, of course, the notion of merging categories. You have to understand, for example, that the other category that is Jewish is so-called Jewish Bolshevism. The big question that historians of the Soviet Union ask is why are so many communists Jews and so few Jews communists, right? This was a very interesting question. It was a very interesting question. In other words, is there a Jewish presence? There's always the argument of Jewish so-called over-representation. This is one of the great accusations. I mean, for example, all of the bankers of Europe are Jewish. In point of fact, all the leading bankers of Central Europe and England, none of them were Jewish, which is actually quite interesting. That's actually quite interesting, by the way. Some of the private bankers were, like the Rothschilds. But of the big banks, there was no Jewish leadership whatsoever. And Jews, by the way, only get into a leadership when the banks go into disrepute over the last 20 years. So that question of Jewish overrepresentation is interesting. The majority of American jazz performers, African-American performers, who come to Europe in the 20s are brought by European entrepreneurs, both in Germany. I mean, the most famous tour, of course, is Duke Ellington's tour in 1926. And that music, of course, is furthered in the United States not by Jewish musicians, but by the great American non-Jewish jazz conductor, Paul Whiteman. And it's Whiteman who has the first performance of jazz at Carnegie Hall and who commissions Gershwin to write Rhapsody in the Blue. Thank you. See, we all get old and lose it. Thank you. Who commissions Gershwin to do to write Rhapsody in Blue. So the answer is there Jewish entrepreneurs? Absolutely. Are there Jews in popular music in Germany, Austria, and the United States? Absolutely. Are they, quote-unquote, overrepresented? Well, you know, that's a very complicated one. That's the question of head counting. The answer is, and the point was made about Vienna, if you take everybody, no. If you take the best ones, maybe. That's another question. That's another question, right? If you look at Tin Pan Alley in New York, for example, you think immediately of people like Irving Berlin. But, you know, the majority of people who are writing are the Irish and the Germans and everybody else, other ethnics. Are they as good as Irving Berlin? Probably not. Probably not. Yeah. Good. Of course. About all of them. About all of them. Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, certainly the negative quotes are the easiest to say, well, they represent a certain attitude. What gets much more complicated is when you look at someone like Mahler, right? And you start to say, how does Mahler wrestle with his clearly defined Jewish identity? How does Hugo von Hofmannsthal wrestle with his clearly defined Jewish identity, even though neither one of them are Jews? So if you read Mahler's letters, if you read the conversations with Mahler, if you read Hugo von Hofmannsthal's unpublished diaries, they're wrestling with them. It's not a secret, right? If you read, and I would not recommend it, but if you read Alma Mahler Werfel's autobiography, I always quote Mary McCarthy about Lillian Hellman concerning Alma Mahler Werfel. Mary McCarthy said, Lillian Hellman, every word she writes is a lie, including the ands and the buts. Alma Mahler Werfel's autobiography is fiction, but it's fiction that represents a certain set of attitudes that she has towards Mahler and that maybe even Mahler had toward himself, being quote-unquote Jewish. So, for example, she says that Mahler would insist that he hold her hand... she hold his hands so he wouldn't gesticulate. But of course, his conducting is always accused of being what? Jewish, because it's wild and crazy. He's the Leonard Bernstein of his time. Right? Interesting, right? So the answer is the negative ones are easy. The ones that deal with complex internal states, how do composers imagine themselves, how do thinkers imagine themselves, it's much more difficult. But in a sense, those are the most interesting ones because then you absolutely wrestle with that. And when, you know, Disraeli says, you know, all music is ours, it's clear that he's being over the top, right? I mean, it's a novel, right? And it's a novel in an age which is still debating Jewish emancipation in England, right? We're not talking in an age in which the British Jews have a kind of open you know, open space in which to live. And again, I'll remind you of Disraeli, baptized when he's a child, right? He's baptized when he's like 6 or 7, because his father wants him to have all the benefits of being Siri, right? Like the queen, Victoria, not Elizabeth. Disraeli, when he's accused as a member of parliament of being a Jew, he has this great line, of course, right, which says, yes, and when your ancestors were in the trees in England, mine were what? Musicians in the Holy Land. Okay? So. Well, it's interesting. Certainly in the case of Bayreuth, we actually have the subscription. You had to belong to the club, right? So you have subscription lists. So the answer is, yeah, that's an easy one. Bayreuth's an easy one. When you talk about the audiences, for example, in Berlin and so forth and so on, that's both a claim and an accusation of the time, right? But there's no statistical evidence for one way or another. What's interesting to me, and it really does interest me, is that Wagner's reception, for example, in England, is in spite of the fact he is an anti-Semite by people who are liberals. And of course, the great litmus test for that is George Bernard Shaw, who's the most important Wagnerian. In a sense, he's the one who popularizes, makes Wagner accessible through his writing on Wagner to the broadest mass of intellectuals, not to the working class, right? But he says in his book on Wagner that, you know, Wagner's a nasty anti-Semite, and do we have to take that into consideration? And he says, yes, we do, but we still have the music. You know, that's the 1890s. I mean, in other words, that's not last week. So the answer is, these audiences know Wagner's proclivity. It's not hidden. It's not assumed, right? And by the way, I don't just mean in his writing, that's the easy part, but in the music, when Mahler talks about Mime, when the writers of the 1890s and 1910s talk about the Meistersinger, right, they recognize the anti-Semitic caricatures on the stage. In other words, it's not subtle, right? And so they recognize it, and they deal with it. And we're back to your question now. Then that becomes an interesting question. Why do they deal with it, right? Is it because it's great music? Well, you know something? It really is great music. It really is, right? But it's also the fact that if you go to the opera house, you belong to a certain club, right? And it's a cool club, because anybody who buys a ticket can go to the opera house, right? I'm old enough to remember the Paris Metro when there were first and second class carriages, right? And as a student, I never had money to go into a first class carriage of the Metro. I always wanted to do that. Not because you got there any quicker, but because it was first class, right? Oh, I just think that's just a great piece of sheet music. It's just a great piece of sheet music. We were talking about American popular culture and the Jews. There are, you know, self-consciously Jewish musicians, performers in the 1920s and 30s, meaning that, again, they sell themselves as Jewish ethnics, much as African Americans were selling themselves as ethnics. German comics, Irish comics were selling themselves, and songwriters were selling themselves as ethnics. In other words, that's a more or less typical bit of sheet music, but it is funny. It is funny. Sometimes you do it just because you can get a response, and I always get a response.
I'd like to come in with a question right here. Many people thought that it seems to circle around two topics. One being the question of being authentic.
Yeah.
And the other one, the question of high culture. High culture, low culture.
Yeah.
And this is, some of these two things, mainly European signifier for European culture,
yeah,
but also signifier for European policies or institutions. This, for example, is very American, British cowboy.
Yeah.
You can't do this. It doesn't make sense on the continent. It does make sense in the States, because the cowboy is definitely a culture.
Yeah.
Way.
Yeah.
And signifier for integration also has
both
irony.
Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the high culture, low culture split is one clearly that I wanted to avoid. Here I was really talking about high culture and the meanings attributed to high culture. And by the way, the meanings of attributed to high culture, especially after the Romantics. You know, I mentioned Daniel Chua's book on absolute music. It's the Romantics who say that music is transcendental. It can have no music, and it can have no meaning in that sense, right? It moves you to a higher sphere. It is human rather than culturally determined. And what Daniel says in his book, and it's a really important argument, is that this is part of the question of exclusion. Because what it says is that if you belong to the right class, if you belong to the right groups, you have that experience. But if you belong to the working class, or if you're a Jew, you are congenitally unable to have that experience. You may mimic it. You may be a good mimic. You know, you may act as if you have that experience, but you can never have it. And that has to do with the ideology of high culture at the beginning of the 19th century. It seems to be inclusive. That is, it talks about the human, but it defines who is human and who is not human in a very specific way. And it's really an interesting debate because, you know, the more, and I've said this before, I'll simply repeat it, the more something talks about not having meaning, the more meaning it does have. I thank you all for your attention. We can have a chat about this. Thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Carol.